John is starting. I just got through the first chapter of the Magician's Nephew. So I haven't gotten to it.
You've already got the book since?
No. No, it's
you mean right?
Oh, my Lord.
Well, it depends on what.
I'm doing the
old order. Old order would have Magician's Nephew number 6.
Oh, you know what? Then my book order, you know, I was just taking it out of this box.
I will stop.
What is the third one?
Well, the third one in the old order would be Don Treader, I believe. After Prince Caspian.
Well, I only read one chapter.
Well, I don't know if you have the handout from the first week, but it has the old and the new order.
I just trusted that. I don't know why I
was it was just kind of put back in there.
I'm glad I said something, because I won't go on the same order.
I'm just fortunate I've got
the
second old order.
There you go.
I don't have to figure it out.
I got the numbers right on that.
I have to look more closely.
First American edition old order.
So,
Collier.
It's the same books, right?
Same books.
Only I'd have to look at my first.
Yeah, to put it in the original order. And I think most people agree that if you've read them before, it's not such a big deal. The first time through, it's so much better to read the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Oh, it's
first.
Yes.
That's the goal. I think that's the goal. First time.
And it's always good to read the last book.
I agree.
That makes a lot of sense. It's actually probably one of the least exciting of all the books.
Yep. It has such a dreadful aspect for such a beginning section, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it really picks up. Yeah. It gets a lot more joyful than after a while. Well, Father.
Greetings.
Greetings. Thanks for coming.
But in this.
Yes.
All of us here as these days.
Wait, one of those other?
No.
Here's the day out of this gives out at the beginning.
Thank you.
I think we know now that 12:45 is a better time to start.
Yeah, well, especially we can expect the stuff that happened at the church.
Yeah, maybe that was kind of a factor too. So we'll just wait. We'll just wait a little bit because I think there's some people that are still coming. New one.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Also, Prince.
No.
Oh, shucks.
Are we going to get the pleasure of hearing you more on this in the future?
More C.S. Lewis classes?
Yeah, more C.S.
Lewis. I don't know if we want to. We have to probably space them out, you know? If we did one every time, it might look a little weird.
Why?
No, I think there's other good things to read.
I'm sorry, I have to agree.
Oh.
Maybe in a couple of years I could sneak it out.
Makes sense, the Holy Fathers. And,
it's
lovely. I think it's great. But
yeah, I'd like to
send
next time I'd like to do a Bible with me, like a gospel book or maybe some letter.
Well, that'll wait come,
okay.
Whatever you do.
I think that'd be good.
Yeah.
But I don't have to do it for a while. Father John's giving me the next class in December.
Oh.
And then
what's that gonna be on?
I haven't heard the announcement.
It's who was it, Frederick Matthews Green, who said every time she reads something really good in Orthodox, she reads C.S. Lewis and he says it better. I'm sorry to say that. I mean that's partly a reason to you want with C.S. Lewis, and I don't mean right away.
Right. I'd like to do something again at another time. Maybe another one of his books. Space trilogy? I don't know. Those are really complicated and interesting. We'll start now. We'll start talking.
Oh, heavenly God, Spirit of truth,
Right, so there's a new handout, so if you just came in, come on up and get the new handout. I'm breaking our pattern, I'm giving it to you now, because maybe there's some stuff we can look at. So let's just start talking about the space trilogy, because that's a good point of entry, because when this discovery was made, this planet Narnia, and it really truly was a discovery, it's analogous to a few things. I mean, it doesn't happen that often, but there's one example that I've heard of, which is in the year 1960, a scholar determined that there was a pattern in one of Spencer's works called an Epiphallenium or something, which I haven't read, I don't want you to know much about it, but the scholar discovered that this whole work was patterned on a 24-hour cycle, and each section was calibrated to a different time of the day. And this amounted to be a genuine literary discovery that was a code sort of discovery. And so occasionally it does happen. And that took 400 years for someone to find out. Wow. Now this took about 50 years until Michael Ward had this more or less revelation. Now the story behind how he came up with this, he was a student of Lewis, and he was studying for a PhD dissertation on Lewis. And if you're coming in, there's a handout you can come grab. And so he was going to write his dissertation on something about Lewis, not this. And one night he went to meet with his advisor, who was Simonton Ward, I think his name was. He knew Lewis back in the late 60s, or early 60s in Cambridge, who was a bishop in the Anglican Church for a while, and was an advisor to Michael Ward when he was working as a young Anglican scholar. And he came to the bishop with a question about wordless prayer, because he was studying in Lewis prayer, particularly this book called Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. And he was struck by this idea of wordless prayer. Well, what's that about? What does that mean? And so he went to talk to his advisor. And in the course of the conversation, the bishop pulled off a book from his shelf, which was Father Sophroni's book about St. Silimon of Mount Athos, and was reading to him a passage about related to this. And Michael Ward describes it in his book. So here's the book that is that sets forth his thesis, you know, and I highly recommend it. Once you've read all the books and you want to go a little deeper, not to start with, I mean, it's interesting only later. So I should preface all this by saying the main thing is just to read the stories and enjoy them. That is absolutely what Lewis wanted, and that's the most edifying thing for us. Only later is it worthwhile, if you're interested, to kind of get into the criticism, if you will, or analysis of the books. Lewis once said that you don't need the critics to enjoy Chaucer, but you need Chaucer to enjoy the critics. In other words, you got to read the story and like it first, and then you can read what other people have said and interpreted. So even the Planet Narnia thing, for as great and amazing as it is, and I believe it is really, it's best to put that aside until you've read the books a few times, digested them, and just loved them and experienced them, because that's kind of what he was really going for. But anyways, so he came, Michael Ward that night in 2003, I think it was, came back from that meeting with the bishop there, and there was something really, he said, electric about that energy. It was like some kind of spiritual experience happening. And he couldn't quite figure it out. And it had to do with the words that were read out of the book about St. Silimon, about wordless prayer. And he didn't quite know what to do with it. He was trying to go to sleep, but he couldn't. And he started thinking in his mind about a poem that Lewis had written called The Planets in the 1930s. And the poem had a line from that went like this. It said, "Of wrath ended and woes mended, of winter past and guilt forgiven, and good fortune Jove is master." And he said that in his mind, when he had those five words, winter past and guilt forgiven, those five words were just, wait a minute, that's the best five-word summary of The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe that I could imagine. And that was in the stanza on Jupiter. And all of a sudden he had this idea of, like, maybe each of the chronicles can be calibrated to each of the seven planets in this poem. And that's when he got out of bed and he kind of had a eureka moment. And he didn't feel like he deserved it or he worked to achieve it. It just came to him. He's very humble when he describes it. It's kind of sweet. But he said that, "I don't know why it was entrusted to me, but I feel like I need to share it with everybody." And I, you know, I was skeptical the first time I heard about it. Like, oh, come on, it sounds corny, you know. But the more you read and the more you look at it, it is so compelling. Because here's the thing, Lewis loved the medieval worldview. He was a scholar, you know, we've talked about that, of that period. And in his academic works, he writes explicitly about the ancient or the medieval cosmological view. So on one of the, in the new handout, on that third page, you see a picture that looks like this. And if you haven't got the handout, come get one, because I gave them out earlier. Come up and get it. Yeah. And so look on that page three, you'll see some, you'll see a picture of the medieval cosmos. And so he wrote about this a lot. One of his most famous books of scholarship is called The Discarded Image, in which he talks about this great image of the meaning-drenched cosmos that has these spheres and things are kind of musically, harmoniously interacting. This is a beautiful picture. It might not have been exactly true scientifically, as we find, but it had some kind of element of beauty and majesty, and in some sense, truth. But in any event, he wrote about that a lot. He cared about the planets, and he wrote about it in his academic work and in his earlier fiction, like the Science Trilogy. So that's Melania, that's what you brought up, like Perelandra. So he wrote the Space Trilogy. The first book takes place on Mars. The second takes place on Venus. He gives them different names. Venus is called Perelandra, and Mars is called, like, Malacandra, and stuff like that. So he loved the planets. So first of all, you got to know that about Lewis. He loved the planets. Second of all, because he was a medieval enthusiast, he liked the secretive element. We talked about that last week. One of the elements of the medieval mind was intricacy and subtlety, and sometimes secretiveness. And what about Lewis himself? He could keep a secret in his own life. His friends didn't know he was married for almost a year. Can you imagine keeping that secret? So Lewis did, and when he wrote his, he wrote a biography, an autobiography called Surprised by Joy, about his own early life. And his friends read it, and they couldn't believe the stuff that he didn't put in there. And they jokingly called it Suppressed by Jack. Because he didn't really talk about things that he might have. So it was kind of selective. So Lewis did have a secretive dimension, and in any event, so... Okay, yeah.
It's more
concerned
about spiritual.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. So that sounds reasonable. So in 2003, he comes home and he gets it all coming together that evening, and that's really when he felt like he made that discovery. And the book itself came out 5 years later, and it was published by Oxford University Press. And here it is, Planet Narnia, The Seven Heavens and the Imagination of C.S. Lewis. And there is a picture of, it looks like Jupiter. C.S. Lewis thought Jupiter was the best planet, the greatest planet. And when he first wrote The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, he thought there was just going to be one book. He didn't really have it all, but he made it a Jupiter book. Okay? It's jovial. And the imagery surrounding Jupiter has to do with monarchy, kingship, and then also it has to do with the suffering king, because there's that little red spot on Jupiter. And it's kind of hard to see this picture, but the red spot, which is a storm, which is the diameter is actually bigger than Earth. See, Earth is actually kind of to scale to Jupiter on this. So Jupiter is a huge planet, and the storm apparently on Jupiter is so large, it's bigger than Earth itself. But his friend Charles Williams once said that red spot is indicative of a wound in the king, Jupiter, a suffering king, blood shed. You know, so there's a correlation to the blood of Christ, the king. And so anyways, the planet, he thought was a great planet. He thought the 20th century knew too much about war and death. You know, he'd been to World War I, he'd seen World War II. And so we knew too much about Mars, we knew too much about Saturn, those planets that were associated with death and with military activity. But he thought we didn't know enough about jovial, monarchical, regal planet. So that's why he shows it for his first book. Now, if you look at the sheet, you can see how the seven planets align to the seven books. Jupiter, Mars, Sol. Remember, the Sun was a planet too. Luna, Mercury, Venus, and Saturn. So what is his discovery? What his argument is basically that Lewis had a secret pattern. He had a secret pattern that he told nobody about. but he used it to inform the imagery in each of those books, the lessons learned by the characters, and as well as the character cast of himself. And you have to really read the book. It's too complex for me to try to explain it because I don't even probably understand it well enough to explain it. But I will say this. In The Silver Chair, now I'm going to assume that we've read The Silver Chair by now, hopefully. I'll talk about The Silver Chair more like to the end in a little bit. In The Silver Chair, because it's the moon book, it's made in the image of Luna. If you knew the medieval planets, you'd know from the title that that's the moon book, because silver is the metal associated with the moon. So each planet had a... So in this old view, you've got Earth right there, static, and all the planets rotating around it, the harmony of the spheres. So that was the pre-Copernican view, right? Later that got ejected because we realized that we're all spinning around the sun. But in the medieval view, so you have all these planets that are rotating around the Earth, and each of them exercises an influence on Earth. The influence of the planets was taken seriously, even by Christians. It's not some necessarily ultra-weird thing, but he has to take some pains to explain what astronomy and astrology were about relative to Lewis's discovery. Because he said one of the reasons people didn't discover this is as Christians were a little bit tentative to get into astrological things, because we think it's superstitious, or like the thing we read in the newspaper when you read about your astrological sign.
Horoscopes,
yeah. So we tend to be like, But this is a little deeper, a little bit more different, I believe. And so he explains that in the book. But so the point is, though, the silver chair, if it's the moon book, it's gonna involve silver, because that's the metal associated with the moon. Just like the soul, or the solar book, gold is associated with the sun. So in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, gold is all over that book. Remember lake where things fall into the water and turn into gold and all that stuff? So gold is everywhere in that book. But this is the silver book. What else are the traits? Well, he says, here are some of the traits. And think about the book now you've read it. An emphasis on water, because Luna is affiliated with water. Even though it's dry, it affects our tides. And that's why water and rain and mist, all the watery imagery. Think about the story starts in that sort of drizzly day in England. And there's just water everywhere you turn in that book. So it's a watery story. Then there's a theme of wandering, both in terms of wandering like on a quest, right? I want you to go find the prince. So there's a spatial sense of traveling, but also wandering in the sense of lunacy, like a wandering of the wits. So Luna, the moon, is where we get the word lunatic and lunacy, because it is traditionally associated with mental instability. So that's why the prince is called a lunatic. He's a lunatic because he's enchanted and he's out of his mind. Problems of doubt or uncertainty, right? So this is really key. Now, I did this little post-it note drawing here, and this is what Lewis explained in his academic books as the great divide of medieval cosmology. In other words, we have the Earth, and the very first of the seven planets is the moon. And that moon is like the boundary between the lower part, which is our earthly, shadow lands, you know, and the upper part, which looks towards deep heaven. And so that's why that divide is really important, because above the moon, or what he called translunary, that's where we have certainty and perfection and harmony and clarity on that side. But on this side, our side of the moon, we have doubt and imperfection and uncertainty. That's why when you remember reading in the book early on, last week we talked about the signs. Remember the signs, and there's a reference to Deuteronomy, the Shema and all that. Here, you know, are the signs, repeat them, etc. So just like God told the Jews in the Old Testament, Aslan says to Jill, remember the signs. Say them to yourself when you wake in the morning, when you lie down at night. Here on the mountain, I have spoken to you clearly. I will not often do so down in Narnia. Here on the mountain, translunary, right, above the moon, the air is clear and your mind is clear. As you drop down into Narnia, sublunary, the air will thicken. Take great care that it does not confuse your mind. The signs will not look at all as you expect them to look. when you meet them there. That's why it's so important to know them by heart and pay no attention to appearances. See, what he was capturing there is this boundary. So this is a story that's really boundary. So I don't know if you remember last week's handout, but it had this, we didn't talk about this chiastic structure all that much, but it's sort of a double mirror pattern. And you can think of the story as kind of a V if you tilt it on its side, depending on how you look at it. But you say, it goes from England, that goes up to Aslan's country, this beautiful, light-filled place. Total clarity. You meet Aslan there, everything's like perfect. But then they drop down into Narnia. Underland, Narnia again, Aslan's country back to England. So it's a perfect symmetry, right? It's a beautiful pattern. It's like the most perfectly structured, I think, of all the seven books that I'm aware of. So, but what's interesting is you could draw a line right here. Aslan's country's up here. That's beyond the moon. But when you drop down into the doubt and confusion, this is why a story, they have so much difficulty remembering the signs, right? Because they're living below the moon. And that's where we live, really, in medieval cosmology. That's why it's so hard for us to stay on track in our spiritual life. Because we're living in a place where holding on to belief is difficult. It's sort of a hostile environment, right? So that's what he's embodying here. So you can see how the story reflects some of these lunar qualities already. What else?
That theme's repeated again in the space trilogy too.
Oh yeah. One of the nice things about this book, for each chapter, he takes one of the planets, and before he gets to the Narnia book, he'll talk about the planet in Lewis's poetry and academic works, and then in the space trilogy, and then finally in the respective Narnia story. So it's super comprehensive. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Just Lewis, or this is to really identify any kind of correlation between the planets and the liturgical colors. You know, like gold and red and silver. And
I don't know. That's very interesting. I haven't heard that.
Can you read that? You can hear it back there.
Is there a correlation between the seven planets and then liturgical vestment colors and so on? So I said I don't know, but that's really an interesting idea. Do you want a handout? Let's see. So the notion of boundaries, which really plays into effect coming down from Aslan's country. And then the word pale. Did you notice how often, like, I have to say, Michael Ward actually takes Lewis to task. He said he really, like, went overboard. He used the word pale so much. Now, is Michael Ward just making this up or what? Well, here's a stanza from Lewis's poem of 1935 called The Planets. There's one for each of the seven. Here's the stanza on Luna. Listen to this. Lady Luna in light canoe by frits and shallows of fretted cloudland cruises monthly with chrism of dews and drench of dream. A drizzling glamour enchants us. The cheat. And it goes on. Melancholy, pale, bleached with gazing. So you could read that and you could already see a lot of the water imagery, the word pale, metal silver, enchantment. It's all in there. Okay? So the white witch becomes the moon witch, really is what she's sometimes called, because she is trying. So the thing about, what do we know about the moon? The moon gets its light from where? The sun. It's reflecting the light of the sun. Not originating with the moon. But when the moon says, I'm the only thing there is, and there is no sun, there's only me, does it sound like a lot of what the witch was saying in that really intense encounter after Rillian is freed? So maybe we should move on to that. Let's talk about that section of the book where they free Prince Rillian. They have that great encounter when they have a chance to actually make the fourth sign and do it right and see if they can actually get it, and they do. And when he asks them to do something in Aslan's name, even though they don't know if it's going to cost them their lives, you know, like, they did it. And so Rillian's free, and he regains his identity. The idea of loss and regaining of identity is so key. That's awesome. They found the prince, and he's found himself. He's regained his identity of who he is. And it looks like things are going to be great until, what, the witch opens the door, and she's back. And she sees that he's been freed from the chair. And at first she's kind of angry, but then her countenance changes. And then she decides to go into her charming enchanting mode. This happens in The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, when at first the witch is going to turn Edmund into a stone or something. She's like, ooh, never mind. And then she goes into her sweet kind of con artist act and entices him with Turkish Delight. So let's look at that that scene, though. So the four of them are about ready to make their, you know, triumphant exit from the Underland, and she walks into the room, and then she decides that she's going to try to put another spell on all of them this time. And she's so subtle, and she puts that green, it's like green is a bad color in this book, right? Everything green, look out, this is going to be trouble. So she puts that green incense on the fire, and things get really sweet, and their minds start to get a little bit messed up. And then she's strumming some stringed instrument, and she's talking in a really peaceful voice, and they're like, hey, we're going to go to Narnia. And she's like, Narnia? What's that? You know? And so she's starting to cast doubt into their mind. Narnia? I've never heard of Narnia. This is the only reality there is. So it's a several-page segment. But I thought I'd just pick up a little bit later when all of them are sort of trying to hold off against her enchantment, because she's trying to basically keep them in the underworld and keep them from escaping and sort of triumphantly re-entering into Narnia. So she's got them in this pseudo-drugged-up enchantment. And Puddle Glum was fighting the hardest against it, right? And I'll just read a little bit. Puddle Glum was still fighting hard. Because the witch had said, there was never any world but mine. And they all said, there was never any world but yours. This is bad. But Puddle Glum said, I don't know rightly what you all mean by a world, he said, talking like a man who doesn't have enough air. But you can play that fiddle till your fingers drop off, and still you won't make me forget Narnia and the whole overworld too. We'll never see it again, I shouldn't wonder. You may have blotted it out and turned it dark like this for all I know. Nothing more like it. But I know I was there once. I've seen the sky full of stars. I've seen the sun coming up out of the sea of the morning and sinking behind the mountains at night. And I've seen him in the midday sky when I couldn't look at him for brightness. So this big moment, I got something going there, and they're like, yes, why, there it is, cried the prince. Of course, the blessing of Aslan upon this honest marsh wiggle. We have all been dreaming these last few minutes. How can we have forgotten? Of course we've all seen the sun. And then Scrub says, by Jove, we have. Good for you, Puddle Glum. You're the only one of us with any sense, I do believe. Finally, Puddle Glum's getting some vindication, because all along he's been the smartest one of them all, but they don't know that, and then now they're starting to realize it. But listen to this. The witch's voice came cooing softly like the voice of a wood pigeon from the high elms in an old garden at 3 o'clock in the middle of a sleepy summer afternoon, and she said, what is this sun you all speak of? Do you mean anything by that word? Well, jolly, yes we do, said Scrub. Can you tell me what it's like? Asked the witch. Thrum, 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 went the strings. Please, it your grace, said the prince very coldly and politely. You see that lamp? It is round and yellow and gives light to the whole room and hangeth moreover from the roof. Now, that thing which we call the sun is like the lamp, only far greater and brighter. It giveth light to the whole overworld and hangeth in the sky. Hangeth from what, my lord? Asked the witch, and then, while they were still thinking how to answer that, she added with another one of her soft, silver laughs, oh, you see, when you try to think out clearly what this sun must be, you cannot tell me. You can only tell me it's like the lamp. Your sun is a dream. There is nothing in that dream that was not copied from the lamp. The lamp is the real thing. The sun is but a tale, a dream. Yes, I see now, said Jill in a heavy, hopeless tone. It must be so. And this witch repeated, there is no sun. And they all said nothing, and she repeated in a softer and deeper voice, there is no sun. After a pause and after a struggle in their minds, all four of them said together, you are right, there is no sun. It was such a relief to give in. There never was a sun, said the witch. No, there never was a sun. This is looking so bad at this point. So bad. But Jill had been feeling something that she had to say. And she says, there's said the witch, quickening ever so slightly the pace of her tale. What a pretty name. What does it mean? He's the great lion who called us out of our own world, said Scrub, and sent us into this to fight Prince Willie. What's a lion? Said the witch. Oh, hang it all. Don't you know? Have you ever seen a cat? Well, surely, said the queen. I love cats. Well, a lion is a little bit, only a little bit, like a huge cat with a mane, and it's yellow. It's terrifically strong. And the witch shook her head. I see that we should do no better with your lion, as you call it, than we did with your son. You've seen lamps, and so you imagined a bigger and better lamp and called it the sun. You've seen cats, and now you want a bigger and better cat. And it's to be called a lion. Well, that's a pretty make-believe. But tell you the truth, it would suit you all better if you were younger. See how you could put nothing in your make-believe without copying it from the real world. This world of mine, which is the only world. Okay, I'll hit the pause button there. So what do we have going on here? Well, we have Lewis arguing with one of the dominant views of the 20th century, which was popularized by Sigmund Freud and was drawn from earlier German materialist philosophers. And he's embodying it in this whole exchange, a super, super creative way to do this. So this scene with the witch is Lewis's like ingenious way of depicting this view that the material world is the only real world, and that any belief in something supernatural is merely a projection of our sense impressions of lower things that we actually can perceive. So the only real world would be the empirical world. The idea of there being a God is, according to Freud, a wish fulfillment childhood fantasy. So it's like a childhood malaise that causes people to want to believe in a father figure. So you start with the idea of a father, and then you decide you want to create a god because you can't cope with living in the real world, essentially. See how the witch is saying, you start with the idea of a cat, and then you come up with the idea of a lion. How cute. Or, there is no sun, but we have lamps. This is the only real world. So this is what Freud said. He got it from this German named Ludwig Feuerbach. Now, he was the German materialist philosopher who wrote a book in 1841 called The Essence of Christianity. Quite the contrary, it was not the essence, but he basically says, we've made God in our own image, projecting our human experiences out there and calling it God. So God is a projected wish longing. Okay? Freud took up the idea himself, and he really popularized it in the early 1900s. He wrote a book called The Future of an Illusion. Freud did in 1927.
What was the name of that?
Feuerbach. F-E-U-B. F-E-U-E-R-B-A-C-H. Feuerbach. I can tell you afterwards. I'll give you it. Okay. So Freud basically says, God is nothing but an exalted father figure, a projection of an ideal father figure. Religion is simply an immature response to an awareness of our helplessness and remembrance of our childhood experience of helplessness. Religion, all religions, he calls, are an infantile delusion and an example of wishful thinking. Okay, so that's what Lewis is going after here, this bottom-up theory of reality. It says the only thing that's really true is what we can perceive by our senses. And anything supernatural doesn't exist. You see the problem with it? It's, there's an a priori assumption. In other words, they are assuming that there cannot be a supernatural world. But on what basis can you do that? That's already a philosophical belief. That's a religious belief they've made. So it wasn't, Freud wasn't a scientist. He didn't do science at all. But he was very popular because it was in the mood of the people. There's a really interesting book called Modern Times by Paul Johnson, and he talks about Albert Einstein unwittingly contributed to this detachment of our Judeo-Christian values, because when he came up with his theory of relativity, the popular mind took relativity to mean relativism. So there is no good, there's no evil, there's no true right, and there's no true wrong. That's what Freud was teaching, more or less. And Freud combined with this popularized version of Einstein, and it really changed the way we think as people, according to Paul Johnson. And the tragic part was that Einstein didn't think that at all. He believed passionately in right and wrong. He believed in a God. He wasn't a practicing Jew. He believed in God. And his whole life he wanted to find a unified field theory of physics because he wanted to bring it all together in this sense of sort of upset that he created in the world of physics that created this sense of relativity or eventually relativism in the popular mind. He regretted that influence. That's not what he was trying to do. All right, so this is Lewis's creative way of displaying the mindset of the 20th century. We call modernism in the form of Freud in particular. So he has an argument with Freud. Let's see, what was I going to reference on that? Oh, well, I should mention too that this also captures a little bit of Lewis's love for Plato. So the Greek philosopher Plato was a big influence on Lewis. Where Christianity differed from Platonic teaching, he would always side with the Christian teaching. But there was a lot in Plato that resonates with Christianity. So you look at the writings in the early Greek philosopher, Plato. Here's some of the correlations. So how is Lewis's Platonism helping inform his Christianity? Well, Platonism holds that besides this world, perceptible by the senses, limited by time and space, there's a world of true and perfect beings outside of time and space. That sounds a little bit like what we understand as Christians. Not perceivable by sense, perception. This other world is our highest aim and our supreme happiness. See how that lends well to a Christian worldview? St. Paul in 2 Corinthians 4 says, the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. So if it's so basic as Christians, we believe in an unseen world. So many people did in the 20th century, maybe even now. So he was arguing against it. All right. Plato also taught the idea of the supreme good. He taught that God cannot be the source of evil. Plato thought that humans have free will. They choose their own fate. He also had this idea of the crucifixion of the just man in Socrates. Although it's a little different because Socrates died for himself, not for the whole world. But there's some parallels. So, Lewis loved Plato's Allegory of the Cave, super famous section of Plato's Republic. You've probably heard about it. Plato's Cave, Allegory of the Cave. So basically the story is Plato's telling the story, there are these men in a cave, chained, staring against a wall in a cave. And all they can see are shadows on the wall. Because behind these chained men, who can only face this way, back there is a raised area with a fire burning. And there's people walking back and forth and holding figures and doing things. And they're casting shadows on this cave wall. That's Plato's Allegory of the Cave. So these people that are chained think what they're seeing is reality. And they can't see what's actually a higher reality that's causing the shadows down here. Imagine someone gets free. One person gets free from their chains. Not only sees the fire and all the people back here, but gets out of the cave and makes it out into the daylight and sees something called the sun. Once his eyes adjusted, he could like marvel at that. And eventually he's going to come back and try to tell the people that are chained up that there's more to reality than just this lower shadow land, right? And they say, you're crazy. Yeah, we're going to kill you. Be quiet. This does not make sense. But that's kind of a rough summary of the Allegory of the Cave. So you can see why Lewis called our lives, he said, these are the shadow lands. Because he believed eternity, the kingdom of heaven, was more true and more real than what we have here. See, the lower things are copies of higher things. See, the witch had it totally. Freud, they said the opposite. Your God is just, you're taking this earthly imperfect father and you're projecting it up. Lewis said, no, our concept of fatherhood comes from what we know about God. It comes down this way. So it's like total inversion. See how he's doing these kind of sophisticated arguments in the context of the story. And you wouldn't even have to know this to enjoy it and kind of get the point of it. Listen to what the writer of the book of Hebrews says in chapter 9. For Christ did not enter a man-made sanctuary that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself now to appear for us in God's presence. So the writer of the Hebrews says, our sanctuaries are a copy of a more eternal, permanent, perfect. And you've heard this analogy to liturgy. Like we're joining in, we're participating in a liturgy going on beyond time in the kingdom. So So this kind of relates to Lewis's argument about the witch. There is no sun, there is no Narnia, there is no Aslan. Well, Plato and Lewis and Christians throughout the ages would want to differ with that. Now what's interesting is how this whole thing kind of resolves. Because they're on the verge, really, of being kind of drugged, and who knows what could happen if they got enchanted finally. So she finally says, there is no Narnia, no overworld, no sky, no sun, no Aslan, and now to bed all, and let us begin a wiser life tomorrow. Remember the serpent? The fruit was good to make one wise. Sounds like exactly like the Garden of Eden. But first to bed, sleep, deep sleep, soft pillows, sleep without foolish dreams. The prince and the two children were standing with their heads hung down, their cheeks flushed, their eyes half closed. The strength all gone from them, the enchantment almost complete. But Puddle Glum, desperately gathering all his strength, walked over to the fire. Then he did a very brave thing. He knew it wouldn't hurt him quite as much as it would hurt a human, for his feet, which were bare, were webbed and hard and cold-blooded like a duck's. But he knew it would hurt him badly enough, and so it did. With his bare foot, he stamped on the fire, grinding a large part of it into ashes on the flat hearth. And three things happened at once. The sweet, heavy smell grew much less. Everyone's minds got clearer. The witch cried out, "What are you doing? Dare to touch my fire again, mud filth!" And she starts screaming at him. Thirdly, the pain brought a clarity to his mind as well. Now, what's so awesome about this is that we have a solution to their problem of belief, a solution to their bad enchantment. They were under an evil enchantment. And what's so interesting is that he took action. And strangely, now this is something that I just thought of this week, and I don't know if anybody will approve of this, but I found a really interesting parallel between Puddle Glum's action here and advice given by Elder Zosima to a woman in the novel called The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. It's called A Lady of Little Faith. It's one of the early chapters in the book. I don't know if you remember this, if you've read it, but this woman has a daughter who needs to be healed, and she's kind of been healed, and the elder sees people all day long. He's like a holy man in this monastery in Russia. And this lady wants to come and talk to Elder Zosima. And he's modeled after some Optima elder, maybe Father Nicholas knows. There's one in particular.
Ambrose.
Maybe Ambrose. Yeah, that sounds right. Maybe Elder Ambrose of Optima. So it's an amazing novel because Dostoevsky is using his real experiences with the Optima elders. But she says to him, "I suffered from a lack of faith." And he says, "Lack of faith in God?" She said, No, life after death, it's such a riddle. And she goes on to explain why she can't believe in life after death. And she's read some, it sounds like modern poet or something, that uses these imagery that makes it seem like once you're dead, it's all over, and the flowers will grow on your grave, and that's the end of your whole story. And so she's been kind of bewitched almost by things in her era. You know, this would have been 19th century. She's like, "What will give me back my faith?" And then, "I believed when I was a child, but how could it be proved?" And she's earnest. You know, she really is. He says, "I believe completely," he says, "in the genuineness of your anguish." He's very pastoral. He's just a great character. And so he doesn't belittle her, but she's really having a problem believing. And then she's like, "It's devastating. It's devastating." She's like crying out. And he says, "No doubt it's devastating. One cannot prove anything here, but it is possible to be convinced." "How? By what?" "By the experience of active love. Try to love your neighbors as actively and tirelessly as you can. The more you succeed in loving, the more you'll be convinced of the existence of God and the immortality of your soul. And if you reach complete selflessness in the love of your neighbor, then undoubtedly you will believe, and no doubt will even be able to..." "No doubt will even be able to enter your soul. This has been tested, it is certain." She says, "Active love?" And he goes on to explain what active love means. But what I think is pretty neat about Puddle Glum, he took action. And it was for not just for himself, but his whole group of friends. And it was costly. It was very selfless. He burnt his feet. It was a great, great thing. And that helped their dilemma. It couldn't prove that there was a sun, but it helped convince them because it cleared their mind. You know, this is the realm of proof. It's like deeper.
The sentence after that,
yeah, pain for Lewis is really important. Like in his book, The Problem of the Pain, he calls pain God's megaphone to get a hold of a sleeping world. So,
it is kind of like somebody that goes out searching for medication, self-medicate. My son self-medicated when it's not legal. And some people do that. I mean, a lot of people's sons and daughters do that. It's not that real big secret. And so I believe that that's what happens. A lot of people go out and they
Yeah, we can enchant ourselves, you know. Well, so there's that great thing. And so Puddleglum takes the heroic action, and then things resolve, and they're able to, she reverts to the giant snake, and they're able to slay her. Fortunately, they didn't have to kill her in the form of a woman. That would have been giant green snake. And then they start to make their way up. And the last thing I'd like to talk about, I think we got just a few minutes. The last thing I want to talk about, hey, so by the way, you know, there's so much we could talk about, but, you know, you almost, like, could murder the story by dissecting it too much, and I hope I'm not doing that, because I really want to preserve this beauty of reading it as a story. That's absolutely what Lewis wants. He doesn't want us to be all breaking it down and getting over the intellectual. But let's talk about one more thing. So they make it to they make it almost to the top, and then they push Jill up through that little hole, and then she disappears, and they're afraid that she's been stolen or injured. They don't know what's going on. In fact, she's popped out into Narnia, right? And she's right in the middle of this thing that they call the Great Snow Dance. And it's such a neat, like, moment in that story, but I want to highlight it because for Lewis, this great dance is like one of his fundamental images in his writing across the board. Paralandra, The Problem of Pain, Mere Christianity, and here, the great dance for him is one of his essential symbols. So let's talk about when Jill pops out of the underworld, reemerges into Narnia. It says, as soon as she got her head out of the hole, she found she was looking down. She had been so long in the dark, her eyes couldn't at first take in what they were seeing. Because it wasn't daylight, which she wanted to see. It was cold. The light was pale and blue. There was also a good deal of noise going on and white objects flying about in the air. It was at that moment that she had shouted down to Puddleglum to let her stand on his shoulders. When she had done this, she could see and hear a good deal better. The noises she had been hearing turned out to be of two kinds. The rhythmical thump of several feet and the music of four fiddlers, three flutes, and a drum. She also got her own position clear. She was looking out of a hole on a steep bank which sloped down and reached a level about 14 feet below her. Everything was very white. A lot of people were moving about. Then she gasped. The people were trim little fauns and dryads with leaf-crowned hair floating behind them. For a second, they looked as if they were moving anyhow, and then she saw that they were really doing a dance. A dance with so many complicated steps and figures that it took you some time to understand it. Then it came over her like a thunderclap that the pale blue light was moonlight and the white stuff on the ground was really snow. And of course, there were stars staring in a black frosty sky overhead, and the tall black things behind the dancers were trees. They had not only got out into the upper world at last, but had come out into the heart of Narnia. Jill felt she could have fainted with delight. And the music, the wild music, intensely sweet, and yet just the least bit eerie, too, and full of good magic, as the witch's thrumming had been full of bad magic. It made her feel it all the more. And then about the snowballs, they weren't throwing them at the dancers, as silly boys might have been doing in England. They were throwing them through the dance in such perfect time with the music and with such perfect aim that if all the dancers were in exactly the right places at exactly the right moments, no one would be hit. This is called the Great Snow Dance, and it is done every year in Narnia on the first moonlit night when there is snow on the ground. Of course, it's kind of a game as well as a dance, because every now and then some dancer will be
the least bit wrong and get a snowball in the face, and everyone laughs, but a good team of dancers, dwarfs, and musicians will keep it up for hours without a single hit. On a fine night when the cold and the drum taps and the hooting of the owls and the moonlight have got into their wild woodland blood and made it even wilder, they will dance until daybreak. I wish you could see it for yourselves. So she goes, she emerges into Narnia and they're having the great snow dance. So that's a sweet moment in the story. But I wanted to show you how he brings up this idea of the dance elsewhere. Because for Lewis, it's a super deep theological point. First of all, in Mere Christianity, he talks about the Trinity. Lewis, one of the favorite ways of describing the inner life of the Trinity, which how can we really know anything about? God in his essence is unknowable, right? Lewis understands it, and that's partly why he liked Plato too, because God could not be found out in his essence. And Christians believe that as well. But we can experience God insofar as he reveals himself to us and as we participate in his energies, right? One of Lewis's favorite ways to describe the divine life was the image of the dance, a figure that hints at heaven's order and sanctity as well as its frolic and festivity. Lewis claimed that one of the most important differences between Christianity and all other religions is that the Trinitarian God is not a static thing, not even a single person, but a dynamic, pulsating activity, a life almost, if you will not think me irreverent, a kind of dance. That's in Mere Christianity. The inner life of the Trinity is a kind of dance. Such an analogy calls to mind early theologians in our tradition who describe the dynamic exchange of love in God as perichoresis. And that's a Greek word that means dance or indwelling, from which we get the word choreography, perichoresis. This indwelling and mutual love and submission among the members of the Trinity is captured in some way by the idea of the dance. So the dance is like copied from something higher. See? Again, it's the reverse of what the witch would say. Amen. That's right. Well, let me give you one last look at the great dance image, as he describes it in the end of his book called The Problem of Pain. So he says the key, really, to life... Well, I'm going to have to do the Mere Christianity, too, so I got two little things again. But he talks about the key to our life is to understand what it means to be self-giving. We have to give of ourselves, because that's the only way to truly become a human being and discover who we are. Because that's what God does. Like Christ didn't consider equality with God to be grasped, right? But he humbled himself. Even the second person of the Trinity had that humility and wanted to lower himself compared to the Father, with whom he was co-equal and co-eternal. So Lewis says, the eternal Word gives himself in sacrifice. And not only on Calvary. From before the foundation of the world, he surrenders begotten deity back to begetting deity in obedience. As the Son glorifies the Father, so also the Father glorifies the Son. From the highest to the lowest, the self exists to be abdicated, and by that abdication becomes the more truly self. And he goes on. He says, our selfhood, he calls it a golden apple. And this golden apple is like the snowball now in the dance we just read about in the Silver Chair. The golden apple of selfhood became an apple of discord when our ancestors scrambled for it and tried to hold on to it. He said they didn't know that the first rule of the holy game is every player must by all means touch the ball and then immediately pass it on. You don't hold on to it. You pass it on. To be found with it in your hands is a fault. To cling to it, death. But when it flies to and fro among the players, too swift for eye to follow, and the great master himself leads the revelry, giving himself eternally to his creatures in the generation and back to himself in the sacrifice of the word, then indeed the eternal dance makes heaven drowsy with the harmony. All pains and pleasures we have known on earth are early initiations in the movements of that dance, but the dance itself is strictly incomparable with the sufferings of this present time. As we draw nearer to its uncreated rhythm, pain and pleasure sink almost out of sight. There is joy in the dance, but it does not exist for the sake of joy. It does not even exist for the sake of good or of love. It is love himself, good himself, and therefore happy. It does not exist for us, but we for it. See, he's saying that we're created to participate in the great dance. It's awesome. So we get to participate in the snow dance. You know, even if we don't get to see one in Narnia, God willing, he says that's our destiny. And you only do it by taking the golden apple of self and giving it away. Giving it to somebody else. Here's how he ends Mere Christianity. There must be a real giving up of self. Until you have given yourself to him, you will not have a real self. You must throw it away blindly, so to speak. Christ will indeed give you a real personality, but you must not go to him for the sake of that. As long as your own personality is what you're bothering about, you are not going to him at all. The very first step is to try to forget about yourself altogether. The principle runs through all life from the top to bottom. Give up yourself, and you will find your real self. Lose your life, and you will save it. Submit to death, death of your ambitions and favorite wishes every day, and death of your whole body in the end. Submit with every fiber of your being, and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will ever be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. And then he ends with this. Look for yourself, and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ, and you will find him, and with him everything else thrown in. That's how he ends Mere Christianity. Keep the snowball flying. Keep the apple going. Don't hold on to it. It's pretty awesome. So that's where we should end. Because, you know, that's not the last image in the book, but that's the first thing that Jill sees when she comes back to Narnia. Of course, the story ends back in Aslan's country before it drops back to England. And there's the great eucatastrophe of the death of King Caspian and his rebirth. Right? That's what Tolkien meant, a joyous turn. It doesn't deny the reality of death, but it says death isn't the final word. So the king comes back to life. And he gets young. Pretty cool. That's probably enough. Hey, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you. Keep reading. Let's all read them again this winter and talk about it. Thanks for coming. Thank you.